I'm Gregory Berg. The following morning show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2015. 2015 was the year of the 100th birthday of legendary filmmaker Orson Welles, who was born in Kenosha. And that centennial was celebrated in the city of Kenosha in a very big way, with a number of Orson Welles scholars coming to town. This is an interview with one of those experts on the life and legacy of the great Orson Welles. Enjoy. As many of you know by now, this is a very big week in the city of Kenosha because we are about to embark on a gigantic event celebrating the 100th birthday of the immortal George Orson Welles, one of the towering figures in the history of American cinema. And one of the experts on Orson Welles who is being brought to town as part of this huge celebration is a film historian by the name of Patrick McGilligan, who actually makes his home right up the road in Milwaukee. But his expertise stretches far and wide. He is well known for previous books he's written, including Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness, Fritz Lang, The Nature of the Beast, George Cukor, A Double Life, and a book he helped put together called Tender Comrades, A Backstory of the Hollywood Blacklist. His most recent book, which will be published a little later this year, is called Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. And in this book, Patrick McGilligan explores many details not ever before revealed to the public about the early life of Orson Welles, including his life being born and for a few years raised right here in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And I'm very excited to have the opportunity to speak with Patrick McGilligan about his work, about Orson Welles, and about his love of film history. Patrick McGilligan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Ahead of talking about Mr. Welles specifically and your visit to Kenosha, I wonder if you could just say a word about where your love of cinema began. Can you point to anyone or anything, any particular moment in which of this took off?
Well, curiously, I'm from Madison, and I grew up wanting to go into theater, and actually started out at the University of Wisconsin-Madison as a theater major, and eventually switched to film, probably because of lack of acting talent. And also, film really combines theater and all the other arts. And I did not watch movies growing up because I grew up on a lake with parents who were Catholic who thought going to movies was a waste of good time and money.
So you are, in some respects, a relatively unlikely person to be doing what you do for a living.
Yeah, but in other respects, likely. I mean, my mother went to the Pasadena Playhouse and tried to be an actress when in the 40s, even though she's from Wisconsin. And she loves show business. And so we were infused, you know, by television and stage, but not film, but we knew all about movies. We knew we couldn't see them, and we heard about them. And of course, there was a lot of crossover between television and stage and film. So by the time I got to college, actually, in 1969, I fell in with a lot of East Coast radicals who knew a lot about film and a lot more than I knew about film. And they were, they were watching old movies in the archives by day and protesting and rioting by night.
And what would be the films which really helped you fall in love with film?
Well, honestly, Citizen Kane is one of them. I went to see Citizen Kane at a college film class with my older sister when I was still in high school. And, I watched it mesmerized because it was a lot different and better than the Roger Corman films that I'd been sneaking into at the Orpheum on State Street. And I always, because I was raised and wanted to be an actor and had a show business, a family interested in show business, I was aware of film, and I was aware that there were, really great films and ones that were not as good. And Citizen Kane, when I saw it, really overwhelmed me. And, you know, to this day, I voted in the Sight and Sound poll in 2012 of International Film Critics and Scholars, and it was on my list of 10 greatest films of all time, which is what you do. You submit a list.
One other question along this line. I've already spoken to your good friend and colleague, Joseph McBride, and one of the things we talked about for at least a couple of minutes was sort of the notion of being a film aficionado at a time when there was no such thing as home video. There were no stores to go to.
Yeah.
There was no Netflix.
Joe is an old friend dating back to 1969, and really an elder statesman, meaning he's older than me. And I listened to every word coming out of his mouth. He knew more about film, you know, when I met him than I probably do today. I mean, he just is incredibly knowledgeable, and he was absolutely an expert on Wells, even at that point in time. But, you know, in Madison, they have the state film archives, which some enterprising archivist managed to collect by the time we got there, that included all the old Warner Brothers films from about 1931 to about 1953, something like that, the RKO films, and I think it's Republic. And so at that point in time, you know, even in Wisconsin, you couldn't even see films on television very often. You know, there weren't that many channels, and people weren't running old movies. And there was no value in the old movies, as far as most people knew or were aware of. And so we used to gather up in the, you know, fourth floor of the State Historical Society and basically rummage through the lists of old titles and choose something we had never heard of or something we had heard of but nobody had ever seen, and all gather around and watch it. And, yeah, it was like it was before video. It was honestly, it was before movies were run on TV round the clock like they are now. And so we were really uncovering and watching films that people hadn't watched seriously or written about historically for, you know, several decades, you know, three or four decades. And it was exciting.
Right, of course. It's just interesting to try to transplant ourselves into a world. I mean, I guess I'm 55, so I'm old enough to remember a world where there were three channels on TV and there were no video stores and no Netflix. So,
you know, the East Coast radicals who arrived, they had seen, you know, midnight movies on TV in New York, you know, for years. So they were incredibly sophisticated and knowledgeable about films. And then they had seen them in theaters, you know, at revivals. But there was no such thing as a revival house or anything like that in Madison. Actually, I ran a film society, as did almost everybody in this group that I'm talking about. You know, I ran a film society, and then we booked our own films, you know, to show them to students and charge money. And that was a great job, and we made tons of money. But we weren't always showing, you know, highbrow films. You know, we were showing films in order to make money. So we were showing films that people would want to go to on a date. You know, that would be the premier reason for what we happened to book. But there were many, many film societies that were augmenting that, springing up, you know, starting in, 67, 68, 69. The Wisconsin Film Society, which was a kind of official one, I think got a little bit of money from the student organization there. That was an incredibly well-run, intelligent series, you know, famous for its intelligent bookings and didn't care whether they made money or not. They just wanted to see this, you know, serious film noir from 1947 or something. So what was going on in the fourth floor of the State Historical Society was also augmented by that, and then by the founding of a film magazine called The Velvet Light Trap, which is quite famous around the world now, but was then just a mimeo that was stapled, and that that all these people, again, including myself and Joe McBride, wrote articles for, and then was initially distributed just on campus, but eventually, you know, was distributed around the world. And, you know, when I first went to Paris, excuse me, you know, in the late 70s with very little money and walking around introducing myself, you know, it meant nothing to introduce myself, even though I had written a book by that time. But to say I worked for the Velvet Light Trap, everybody knew it.
At any rate, you are doing this at a time when, I mean, most Americans would have probably maybe heard of Citizen Kane, but the vast majority of Americans would never have seen Citizen Kane unless they were alive and going to movie theaters back in 1940. But it's just kind of strange to imagine such a world. I mean, we live in a world now where if there's any film that for any reason you're curious about, there is almost surely a way for you to see that film and maybe to see it today.
Well, yeah, and it makes people lazy because I teach film at Marquette University now, and you know, I have a rule that people have to sit in their seats and watch the film from beginning to end, and that attendance is a very important part of the class, because everybody will tell you, oh no, I can go home and watch it and rent it, and I've seen half of it, or I've seen it 12 times while they're going in and out of the room, you know, like doing something else, because everybody's multitasking, and nobody pays any attention to a film like Citizen Kane now in quite the same way. But I mean, I have to stress that I was falling in with a bunch of people who were very, very sophisticated on a lot of levels, had many, many things that they were, that you could listen to them talk about, whether it was sports or literature as well. And I didn't go to see Citizen Kane. You know, my sister took me. I had never heard of Citizen Kane. I had never heard of most of the films, you know, that people were taking me to or telling me to go see. So I was listening to people like Joe McBride, who's not an East Coast radical, but also all the East Coast radicals and people who came there, some of whom were, you know, had already written books or were working on their, you know, master's theses on film subjects.
Hmm. You know, as I hear you talking about this, it makes me think of my sphere of music. And I think of somebody like Johann Sebastian Bach when he was composing his cantatas, hundreds of cantatas. He was doing so, as far as we can tell, with absolutely no notion of immortality, that somebody 100 years or 200 years or 300 years later would still be singing this cantata and would be thinking about Bach. It was all about, I have to get this cantata done for Sunday. And it was very much about creating art for the moment, not for posterity, not for immortality. And in some respects, you wonder about those who created films in an era where there was no means by which films were perpetually re-presented to the public. You wonder how much the typical filmmaker thought about immortality either.
Well, I pretty much know, because I interviewed many of them, and I've written books about, you know, a fair number of them as well, and I've really studied them, that most of them didn't think about it. I myself never watch films on television unless I'm obliged to for some reason, because they would never conceive of seeing a film that they had made on a small box, you know, or on a small screen. Wells, for example, in many, many interviews, scoffs at posterity. And I think he was, even though he had vaulting ambitions and was more, I would say, steeped artistically than some of the sort of journeyman directors in Hollywood, you know, he was making films for the moment and wasn't thinking about you know, the 2012 Sight and Sound poll or the Blu-ray or Criterion version, you know, that was going to be released, you know, after his death. So, yeah, they were, you know, I don't want to say they were humble, because they weren't all humble, but they were working to do the best they can under the conditions they could, and not thinking that. And I know it, because I lived through a time when you had no concept of there going to be a video or a cable channel or your ability to replicate these things and take them home and put them on your shelf, that they weren't thinking of that. And Hitchcock, you know, for example, spent a long time, you know, barring his films from being shown on television. It's really only after his death, and after he sold his name to Universal in the mid-1960s, that begins to change. And not because he detested television, because he had a television series, which is quite good, but because his films were not made for television.
Hmm. And nor was Citizen Kane, for that matter. I mean,
nor was Citizen Kane. And I still, you know, I have students, and they're good students, and they're good kids, and they'll say to me, I saw such and such a film the other day, it was really amazing. And I say, where did you watch? And they say, on my TV set, you know, or on my computer. And I just can't imagine watching some of these films on your TV set or the computer. I mean, of course, it limits what you can see. And a lot of the films we were seeing on the fourth floor of the State Archives were being projected on the back wall.
Hmm. So not the fanciest circumstances either. Is that where you saw Citizen Kane for the first time?
No, I saw Citizen Kane, it's important to say, in Professor Russell Merritt's class, and he was a real sort of towering figure in most people's minds at the time because he taught film and he was very knowledgeable. He's still around, and he has written quite a bit about Wells and D.W. Griffith, and you know what you had to do to graduate and what your requisites were was vastly different. So film studies was a very attractive sort of bulking up of your credits, and it still is today. I mean, my classes at Marquette, students take the class partly as a relief, you know, from more taxing obligations, and I have students who are, you know, biochemistry majors and that sort of thing, and they say, I really love this class because it's the one class where I can really, you know, enjoy what I'm learning.
Hmm. So did you get Citizen Kane the very first time you watched it? I mean, did you absorb its greatness and understand that film?
I think, honestly, up until that point in time, I think the first film I ever actually saw in a theater was Ben-Hur because, of course, it's so Catholic that it could have been The Alamo. It was one of those two. So I had not seen a lot. I knew it was a great film. I didn't know why. Still today, people are writing books about why it's a great film, and people can talk for hours about why it's a great film, and for good reason, because it has all that complexity of work and thought and imagination and context and subtext and everything else in it. No, I didn't know that. I don't know whether I know it today, meaning it's a hard thing to know. Well, you're talking about Bach, you know, I mean, Citizen Kane will probably be around and discussed, you know, 400 years from now as an immortal work, and people will still be saying, well, what's great about it and why it's so great.
Just like they do with the Bach B minor Mass.
That's right.
I'm speaking with Patrick McGilligan, an expert on film history and the author of a book coming out later this year called Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. And Patrick McGilligan is one of the film historians who is being brought to Kenosha by the Orson Welles Society as part of this monumental centennial celebration here in the hometown of Orson Welles, the place where he was born. Mr. McGilligan, we should talk about Orson Welles and Kenosha, Wisconsin. First of all, a bit about your research into these earliest years of Orson Welles' life. He never returned to Kenosha later in his life and spoke rather disparagingly of it. Did you find it difficult to uncover a lot of hard and fast verifiable information about the early years he spent in Kenosha?
Well, let me say, I don't think I'd ever been to Kenosha except, I think, maybe to a Kenosha Tremper high school game or something, you know.
Mm.
And I certainly never spent time in Kenosha. And I have a father-in-law who was born and raised in Kenosha, used to speak of it lovingly and at great length. So part of the attraction of the book for me was that I could spend time in Kenosha and look into the Kenosha years and look into this idea of, you know, one of the world's greatest filmmakers of all time, having been born, you know, down the road, basically. And I had to have belief, as I always do starting out on a project, that even though there were dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of books about Welles, that good reportage and research or the best reportage and research had not been done. I was pretty sure that was true about Kenosha, because it's always limited in any story that or article or book about him to just not much, you know, just a sort of passing mention. So I, you know, determined to read all, you know, microfilm for all the years that his parents lived there as a couple, which turned out to be 15 to 16 years. And then a couple years before and a couple years after, daily microfilm of the Kenosha News, which is not available electronically, so you can't index it. And it turns out that they're on the front page all the time. They were major figures, major civic figures. They were quite remarkable people. They had a very public marriage. Orson's birth is on the front page of the Kenosha News. So this made my job very happy, except that I was reading microfilm. And then I spent time, you know, at the Historical Society and at Parkside, and a lot of time at all of these places, and discovered, yes, there was a very rich prehistory, and a lot, many pages go by in the book before Orson is born, because his parents... I don't want to give too much away or say too much, but Orson is not the first Welles to appear in a motion picture. Orson is not the first Welles to shake the hand of a president. His mother was a quite amazing character who was very, very well known throughout the city, not just as a suffragist, a leading suffragist, but also as a dramatist and as a director of drama and as a recitalist, both word recitalist and pianist, and then the first publicly elected female official in the city of Kenosha as on the school board, and on and on and on. She has many, many quite amazing traits, and the father is every bit as interesting. At one point, you know, rumored to be whispered as a great candidate for mayor, leading businessman, inventor, union buster, a male suffragist, of which it was very hard to find very many at a certain point, but, you know, signed a public declaration, you know, in favor of women voting. And I think I don't really accept that Orson was, you know, made disparaging remarks about Kenosha, period. He made sometimes wry jibes or pokes at Kenosha, and other times I think he was fairly amusing and tolerant on the subject. You have to understand he left when he was 3 years old. You have to understand the seeds of his parents' divorce are in Kenosha. And then they both died young, and both were very bitter occasions for him, and on both times he went back to Kenosha. And they were buried, and he was there for the services, and these were terrible memories for him. So he had to weigh all that against the place that he had only spent, you know, 3 years in as a kid. Plus, you know, this is a guy who's a world traveler who lived in, you know, most of his life or a lot of his life in places like Rome, Madrid, Paris, et cetera. And, you know, he's forever having to spell Kenosha, you know, to interviewers, I think he had a sense of humor about it. He always said, and I don't mean a sense of humor because it's funny, but because this was a fact, but it was also in many ways a very unhappy fact, but not because of Kenosha, but because of these other associations,
right,
which I've mentioned. But in many interviews, he says he's a proud Midwesterner. He's a proud American. He always says Midwesterner. And then he lived, you know, most of his young life in Chicago, Woodstock, Lake Geneva, Madison, and northern Wisconsin. So he was around. Hmm. And he went back to Kenosha other times for up until, I think, his father's burial. And so, I mean, I think he was familiar with it, and I think it's just these unhappy memories and the fact that he had only spent 3 years there as a kid made him, you know, I would say conflicted on the subject.
Sure. How did he do in school? What kind of a student was he?
Well, he's obviously brilliant in some ways, and in other ways he was, let's say he was challenged by arithmetic and spelling, for example, but he did great because he only started to do great when he went to the Todd School at Woodstock, which is a prep school and a boarding school, and an exemplary prep school and boarding school. And he really threw himself into school theatricals, and he eventually took over, you know, the entire operation, which was kind of complicated and immense. Many levels of drama groups and productions, including they were doing, you know, they started to do very challenging, ambitious productions, Shakespeare, etc. So he took over that, and then he became the star of the school. And meanwhile, he is getting really, really good grades so that by the time he graduates, he's on, you know, what their equivalent of the dean's list was. However, he was also paying, you know, students to write this paper for him or write that paper for him, because there were some things he didn't care about, and there were some things that he could not master. But he was a good student. Actually, he was the prize pupil of the school by the time he left. And most of those kids, now remember, he graduates when he's from what is really a kind of mid high school, so it's not all the way through high school. When he's 16 years old, most of them go on to another prep school or to college, because that Todd school only went through 10th grade. And he never went to school again. So he was educated at home when he was very young by his mother, by his father, by a series of tutors, by a kind of glittering circle of extended family surrogates, which I write about in the book. And so he was getting a really good education just going to dinner, you know, some nights.
Well, and a very unconventional sort of education in some respects, which maybe helps explain why he became such an unconventional man.
Yeah, and he's an incredible, all throughout this, he's an incredible bookworm, and he's able to soak up things very quickly. But after age 16, he's entirely self-taught and self-learned. And he was pretty learned. I mean, he was very, very intelligent on a lot of different subjects, not just theater or the arts, which he could talk about as well as any professor. So he was a good student, but with some asterisks.
Right.
And not a good, for example, athletics is another one, you know, sports. He would do anything possible to get out of them.
Hmm. And then by the age of 16, you say, when he's basically done with formal schooling, by that point, both of his parents have died.
His father had just died, so that was, his mother died in 1924 when he's about nine. His father dies in, I think it's 1930, right at the end of 1930. So he's 16 and 31 when he graduates, and that's when he leaves America and goes to Ireland. So, you know, he overcame a lot.
No kidding.
I mean, he not only overcame a very bitter and difficult divorce that separated his mother and father, who, as I, you know, say, are really remarkable characters who are really forged in Kenosha. He not only overcame that, but then he overcame their sudden and young death.
Mm. Was he on his own then at the point? Or, I mean, did he have a legal guardian of some kind at that point?
He did, and that person figures into the story in a kind of fascinating, ambiguous way. His name was Dr. Maurice Bernstein, and he practiced in Kenosha, and he was on the city board of health, and he's quite a character. He was eventually treating everybody in the Wells family, all of whom had various problems, medical problems, or advising them as to their medical problems, depending on what they happened to be. He was principally an orthopedic surgeon, but he did, as doctors did in those days particularly, he did a bit of everything. And when they left and went to Chicago, moved to Chicago in 1918, about a year or two later, he followed them, and he was very close to the family, kind of a like second father, but not really, you know, to Orson. Had a big crush on Orson's mother, who kind of was amused by his devotion. And then when the father died, he was named as the guardian for supposedly, you know, the millions that awaited Orson when he came of age, age 24, I think it is. Might be 25. And, you know, the Chicago papers say, you know, said rich boy, you know, and that was actually the phrase, you know, rich boy will have a guardian and inherit, a fortune when he comes of age. Never turned out to be true, unfortunately, for mysterious reasons, let's say, partly owing to the Depression, I would say, as well. But, and this person follows him through life. He's really his guardian from age 16 to, I think, age 24 or 25. And, well, let's get this straight as long as we're talking about it. It's 25. And so he eventually moves to Beverly Hills and opens his practice there, and his clients include Ida Lupino and Joseph Cotton and Rita Hayworth and all the people that were friendly with Orson.
Fascinating. You mentioned the fact that young Orson Welles, I guess not long after his father died, traveled to Europe. Just say a brief word about how significant this time in Europe was for Orson Welles, particularly artistically. What did he experience there that perhaps inspired him or helped shape the artist he was to become?
Well, at that point in time, he was thinking of becoming a painter, and he had an uncle, or they called him uncle sometimes. He was actually his mother's cousin, who was an eminence at the Chicago Art Institute, so he had spent a lot of time there. He had studied art, but he was also known in school for his starring and directing in these theatricals, so there was some question in his mind and amongst the people that were in charge of him and able to give him any money to do anything, whether or not he was going to be an actor or in theater or a writer or an artist. And he was always quarreling with Dr. Bernstein about this because Dr. Bernstein controlled the purse strings. He was the guardian. That summer when he graduated, he actually tried to get a job in summer stock. He advertised, his talents as an actor. And then by the end of the summer, he refused to go to college. Quarreling with Dr. Bernstein at the end of the summer, he proposed a hiking trip of Ireland, and he was going to go to Scotland too, but he never did. And the hiking trip would kind of involve him doing a lot of painting, working on his painting, and then he would end up at Trinity College and apply there. And Dr. Bernstein was partly glad to get rid of him because Orson was always very demanding. If he was around, you had to be involved in his conversations and in his projects and his ideas. And so I gave him an allowance and sent him off. And I think, he had a strategy. He knew there was this really, really terrific theater company in Dublin called the Gate Theater, run by two flamboyant, a flamboyant gay couple who were putting on both new as well as ambitious reinventions of classical productions, and he wanted to go there and audition, and that's also where Trinity College is, so he knew he would end up there. But meanwhile, he sort of traipses around Ireland on his donkey for a while, on his donkey cart, and painting and, meeting people and being Orson, meeting the President of the Republic and meeting famous people, because he's quite good at that in life. And I think he became a professional actor in Dublin. He went in, he exaggerated his resume, they hired him, he was playing a second lead right away, and then he got, really, really important roles for about 6 months, and he was the talk of the town, and everybody was praising him, and he was often playing fat old men. He was 16 years old. then he also, by the way, did directing there of a auxiliary production unit. He did stage design. He wrote publicity under a false name. So he was really, the false name is some kind of anagram of Kenosha too. But it's something that's called Noel Shane, which is like, there's somewhere buried in there is an anagram of Kenosha. And anyway, he came of age. I mean, he really realized he wasn't a painter, or he loved painting, but he would never be a good one, a good enough one to make a living. And it was a different sort of work. I don't think he's a very solitary person, really. Actually, he's very social, and theater and film is a very social profession. You mingle and collaborate with people constantly. And I think he loved theater. He decided he was born to the theater, and his mother and father had loved theater, by the way, and had taken them to everything and backstage to meet everybody. And whenever they came to Kenosha, they came over to dinner, the important people who were playing town. So he loved theater. He knew all about the great actor managers, and seeing these two people in Dublin running the Gate Theater, he had the idea, you know, cemented in his mind that he could be a kind of actor manager like they were, with his own loyal troupe putting on a variety of works for the public. And he was interested in a variety of works, everything from highbrow classical productions to the lowest brow slapstick, you know, rude comedy. And that really is what he did for the rest of his life. So it was formulated and probably in his mind before he got there, cemented by the experience. And, you know, up until the end of his life, that's really what he was. He was an actor manager. He created projects, you know, brought the troupe along, acted in them, told everybody what to do. And that's, you know, that's what all those projects are, including Citizen Kane, which is a Mercury production, and Mercury is really just Orson. Hmm. And then whoever he gathers around him.
So what ultimately brings him back to the United States? I mean, it sounds like he had a spectacularly exciting experience in Europe, and particularly there in Ireland. What in the world would compel him to return home? Homesickness?
Well, he had various conflicts there, which I don't think were really that important, but he wanted to play leads. He was never going to play leads because that's what the two people who ran the company did. So he was always playing second leads and character leads, you would say. And then he was being enticed to London by agents and producers who he had been written about quite a bit, including even in the New York Times at age 16. So he was being enticed to London to see people there. I think he was running out of money and probably he wasn't making very much money. And probably he was greatly homesick because his letters back home during this period of time are full of endearments for the people that he's left behind and with hopes to come back. And he was hoping to come back and have a job teaching at the Todd School, you know, teaching drama at the Todd School. So What brought him back? It probably was a combination of homesickness as well as he had done that and he was moving on. He's a guy, by the way, in all life who has done that and is moving on.
So in our last couple of minutes, I want to hear just a little bit about the rest of the pathway towards Citizen Kane. And I think, of course, most people who know at least a little bit about Orson Welles know that he was involved in some very intriguing theatrical projects from the mid to the late 1930s, including, of course, the really famous productions of The Cradle Will Rock and War of the Worlds over the radio that were quite intriguing and important projects for him, and lots of others besides. What was the sort of overall nature of the work that Mr. Welles was doing at this point in time?
Well, I mean, partly that's the story of the book, because he's growing. He's blossoming, he's magnifying, he's in various ways collecting people and things that he is going to return to and work on when someone gives him the money and the opportunity. And it takes a little while. He eventually ends up in New York, newly married, after having done a national road tour with Catherine Cornell's company in a Shakespeare production, which Thornton Wilder helped him get that job, as did Alexander Wolcott. But he ends up with his new young wife and getting radio jobs. And he's hooked up with a guy named John Houseman, who was also sort of rising star in the New York firmament, a producer slash director slash writer, although he always did more producing than directing or writing. And Houseman gets offered the head of the New York unit, what they called the Negro unit or the Harlem unit of the Federal Theater Project, and he immediately hires his friend Orson to direct the voodoo production of Macbeth, or what was Orson's idea for the voodoo production of Macbeth, an all-black Macbeth in Harlem, with mostly unschooled actors. It's an incredible sensation that launches him into a different Federal Theater Project unit, which is just him and Houseman and whatever they want to do, Uptown and Broadway. When that closes because of The Cradle Will Rock, all these things, by the way, headlines in the stage world in and in New York, and just grabbing people's attention and sensational productions. Then when Cradle Will Rock is closed down by the federal government because of pressure from the right wing, then they open it themselves commercially. Then they decide to go alone commercially, and they form the Mercury Theater, begin to do celebrated stage productions one after another, in which the staging and Orson's acting, and he really conquers New York. And all the time that he's doing this, he's doing, you know, radio stuff and growing in that sphere, you know, first doing itty-bitty poetry readings at noon, you know, or even, and commercials, you know, and anything, because he never had the money, you know, that he even tried to pretend that he had, you know, so he was always making money, you know, to keep going. And he's growing up in radio and commanding more and more attention in radio, starting to do Shakespeare in radio, and they offer him a radio series, you know, Mercury Theater on the Air, and then he does War in the Worlds, which takes him out of the realm of show business into the realm of headlines and front pages around the world, and really establishes his name, you know, and I think magnetizes his name in Hollywood, makes him all the more attractive to producers who all along have been taking him to dinner at 21 saying, please come, you know, to Hollywood. And eventually, you know, if he had never gone to Hollywood and made Citizen Kane, he would be famous in Broadway annals and in radio history, not just for sensational productions, but for important, serious productions that everybody admired.
Your subtitle for your book is intriguing: The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. I wonder if you could just explain why you have titled your book in that way, and what you are trying to tell us about young Orson Welles by talking about luck and genius in the same phrase.
Yeah. Well, the simple answer is the publisher did it.
Okay.
But the answer is probably more complicated. The original subtitle was The Backstory of Citizen Kane, meaning everything that is in the background of how this great film came to be in Orson's young life. And they wanted something a little different, and we ended up deciding on that. But genius, he was called a boy genius in the newspapers by third parties, not just like his friends and family, when he was very, very young, and I follow it in the book. It's repeated. It becomes and it's repeated by people who don't even know they're repeating it. In other words, he goes one place, they call him a genius. He goes another place, they call him a genius. So they meet him, they talk to him, they interview him, they say, this guy's a genius. He's only 16 years old, and look what he's talking about and doing. So he had to live that down as well as live up to it, okay? And at the same time, he said many, many times in interviews that he had a tremendous amount of luck in his life and career, especially towards the end of his life when he was very reflective on these questions. And I think he was serious. I think he was being serious, and that's a serious remark. He would say, I had a lot of very, very good luck, and I had a lot of very, very bad luck, you know. And so Dublin was very good luck. Citizen Kane was very good luck. You know, the death of his parents was very bad luck. Things that happened to him later, very bad luck. And he said, you know, a lot of what happens to you is luck. And luck can be another word for fate. He believed, you know, that everything wasn't due to his genius. Which was, he'd put quotes around that word and hate it, but a lot of it was also due to his luck, good luck and bad luck. And you see it in the young story, you know, before you see it in the old story.
Hmm. By the way, did you ever have the chance to meet Orson Welles?
No, but I have a funny story about not meeting him.
Please.
Because we did attend the AFI event where he walked out on stage looking like Moby Dick, although all in black, a black Moby Dick, and was quite a sight to behold. I was supposed to interview him for the New York Times Sunday Magazine once, and was asked to do that as part of a feature, And so I wrote him a nice letter and, you know, said, I'm from Wisconsin and, you know, I think, you know, for the sake of Kenosha, you know, you should speak to me at least. You know, I have to say, I have to preface this by saying I've lost this letter, which is, I don't lose much, but when I lose something, it's usually something really, really good. But he sent me a letter back, and he said he had to decline for the time being because he was very busy. But really, you know, he felt badly doing so because he would like to do anything for the sake of good old Kenosha.
Really?
Yeah, very nice. Again, a very nice, warm, funny, ironic, you know, comment.
Huh.
And it was a very nice note. And I remember vividly because, you know, everyone will tell you that he disparages Kenosha. And I just think that's not quite right.
Right. There's a more behind the story, as is so often the case when we're talking about anything related to the great Orson Welles. Well, as we said at the very top of this interview, you are one of a host, an array of Orson Welles experts coming to Kenosha to be part of this really monumental celebration of his life and his legacy in this celebration of his 100th birthday. And we want to remind people about your book, which will be out a little bit later this year, titled Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane, published by Harper. And there are all kinds of other interesting books you've written that people will perhaps want to seek out. I know I, for one, am anxious to seek out this book called Tender Comrades, A Backstory of the Hollywood Blacklist, which sounds very, very intriguing. But in the meantime, I'm so grateful for this opportunity to have spoken with you about the early years of none other than Orson Welles. Thank you so much, Patrick McGilligan, for your time.
Thank you for hosting me.